Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Jackson Hole, Fed, Jay Powell, all top of mind for the newsroom this past week. And coming up, we're going to actually zoom out a bit for a look at how inflation and the economic slowdown have impacted the business world this summer and really all of us consumers.
We'll also get a pulse check on the venture capital space and dig into the retail sector with the CEO of Petco. Plus, our cover story details the causes and devastating effects of a contaminant found in a Michigan baby formula plant earlier this year. It plays into the ongoing nationwide shortage.
So troubling on many, many levels. All right, all of that and more to come. We begin, though, with the tsunami of shutoffs. Surging electricity prices spurring the worst ever crisis in late utility payments. It was a Bloomberg Big Take from this past week. You can also find it in the economics section of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. That is out now on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com, and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Will Wade, Mark Chediak, and Ben Holland wrote the piece. Will is Bloomberg News Power and Renewable Energy Editor, and he joins us now. Will, it's good to have you with us. So this is something that some 20 million U.S. households are dealing with right now. That's about one in six American homes that are unable to pay surging electricity bills. Why?
Well, the basic issue is that the price of electricity keeps going up. It's about 15% higher than it was a year ago. And it's probably going to keep going up because it's all tied to natural gas. And natural gas prices have doubled from a year ago.
You know, it's interesting what I think about. And whenever I talk, Will, with our European colleagues, they're like, you know what? We've been dealing with this for a while, certainly because of the Russian war in Ukraine. Give us a little perspective as we kind of, you know, even zoom out a little bit wider.
You know, that's totally fair. It is good to put it in a global context because we're looking at this issue here in the United States. And it's serious. But we're thinking here about people who can't afford to pay their bill. And if you go to Europe and Asia, there's places where they're worried about not having enough electricity to go around, especially come winter.
It also comes at a time when, interestingly enough, government aid that happened during the coronavirus pandemic dried up. So what's the connection between a lack of government help and then an inability for so many millions of Americans to be unable to afford their bills?
Well, during the pandemic, the government passed, or actually state governments, many states had policies that said you can't shut off people's power. And that was because so many people were out of work. Most of those policies have ended mostly towards the end of last year and beginning of this year. But then in a lot of states, especially up north, there's winter shutoff moratoriums every year. They say you can't shut off people's power when it's really cold because literally people can die. So we're coming out of both of those things right into the spring. And in spring is when everybody started saying, wait, what's this inflation thing? Why is everything so much more expensive? So a few months down the road brings us to now. And that's when we're seeing people's bills have gotten high. People are behind on their bills and the utilities give people grace periods. And now they're like, well, the grace period's over. We're going to have to start shutting people off.
I got to say, Will, with a story like this, what's great is you guys zoom out and then you zoom in and you talk about one family and one individual, Adrian Nice. Tell us a little bit about when you start to really get to the granular level, like what jumps out for you?
Well, I spoke to her several times while I was doing the reporting. She's 45 years old. She's a house cleaner. She lives with her teenage son in Minneapolis. And she's just been really struggling. You know, she's a house cleaner. So in 2020, when the pandemic happened, one of the first things that happened is all our clients said, sorry, I don't want you to come over. She's been getting work coming back, you know, since in the past few months. But in the meantime, she had a utility bill that climbed up to like $3,000-something. She was getting shut off notices from her local utility, and she just didn't have it.
You write that even though a larger family lived in the same unit that she was in before, because electricity prices have gone up so much, just for her and her son, who weren't using ostensibly that much power, their bill was even higher just because of the rise in prices.
Yeah, exactly. Last year, she was sharing the apartment with a friend, and the friend had two children. And then the friend and her kids moved out, so there were two people instead of five people in the unit. But the power bill is basically the same, even with much less consumption. And, of course, she had to pay all of it herself. Natural gas, really, there's just not enough of it to go around all around the world. The U.S. is the biggest producer of gas in the world, but we export a lot. And if we chose to keep some here in the U.S. so prices would go down, then there'd be, you know, more potential power shortages in Asia and Europe. You know, our friends over there really need it, especially since the war has completely upended the gas market.
You know, it reminds us of kind of how fragile things are. Like, I think about, well, for such a long time in the U.S., because of fracking and just a lot of development in the energy space, carbon fuel specifically here in the United States, that, like, we talked about having a glut, right? It was natural gas was so cheap, but right? But how quickly, unfortunately, with the war, Russian war, you know, in Ukraine, how things have changed pretty quickly. And this has really hurt a lot of global pocketbooks.
It really has. I mean, I've been covering this for a long time, and just everything about the electricity market for years and years, it was, well, gas is so cheap, we can't compete with this. That's why we see nuclear power plants closing. But gas was like $2 or $3 for years and years. It hit $10 a couple of days ago. I think it's just $9 something now. So it's just crazy. In Europe, especially Germany, you hear people saying, well, they want to stop using Russian gas. But if they stop using Russian gas, then they got to get it from somewhere. And the whole market's tied together. It's a big world, but it's all tied together.
Well, it's a really big story. It was a big take this week. A really big thank you to you, Will Wade, Bloomberg News Power and Renewable Energy Editor, for joining us to talk about this important subject.
U.S. households owing about $16 billion in late energy bills. Tim, that's double the pre-pandemic total, according to Will's and the team's reporting.
Yeah, and the question also is, you know, where's the relief in sight, right?
Exactly.
We can't see it right now.
No, right? All right, coming up, this week's cover story. Our Business Week investigative team reveals how a deadly bacteria found its way into a key link in America's baby formula supply chain.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, one of the more troubling stories to make headlines so far this year, America's shortage of baby formula. And supply chain snarls alone, not the only culprit in this life-threatening development affecting children across the U.S. Turns out, a deadly contaminant found its way into products at an aging Michigan factory owned by Abbott Laboratories. The details, this week's cover story of Bloomberg Business Week. So let's get to it with Bloomberg News senior investigative reporter Susan Burfield, who joins us in our Interactive Brokers studio here at Bloomberg headquarters, along with us, Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber. He's on the Access Line in Massachusetts. I got to say, Joel, Paul and I have been talking about this story, how disturbing it is.
Yeah, well, the circumstances have been extremely disturbing for all the parents in America who have infants. And so, you know, obviously formula is one of these things that you really probably take for granted. I know we did when we had a child. And then all of a sudden you face a shortage and you can't get a very essential ingredient for, you know, raising a healthy child, young child. What was upsetting about this particular reporting was that, you know, that shortage, which affected millions of Americans, actually had a different route than so many other supply chain snarls that we've faced during the pandemic. And this one actually was because of a bacteria called Cronobacter that surfaced not only in cans of formula, but ultimately in one of the main plants that America gets its formula from. So Susan had been working on this, and we just kept telling her to go bigger and tell us and get to the bottom of what happened, and she did. So Susan, get to the bottom of it. What happened?
Months and months of reporting later.
Yeah. Well, you're right that, you know, the formula shortage was on a lot of people's minds and got a lot of attention in May and June of this year in particular. But what we discovered is that back in February, there was a recall of products that were made in a particular plant, as you mentioned, owned by Abbott, located in Sturgis, Michigan, and responsible for about 20% of the whole supply of infant formula in the country. The reason for the recall was that there was a bacteria that can be really dangerous and even deadly for infants, and it was found in the plant, and it was the reason that they had to recall almost 70 million cans of Similac and other formulas. What we also found is that there was almost a year's worth of warnings at the company, and warnings that the FDA probably should have picked up on and didn't, that, you know, had they, maybe none of this would have happened.
So, Susan, that's kind of where I wanted to go. I guess we've, I don't know, all become somewhat used to corporations cutting corners, maybe to, you know, boost profits or whatever. But that's why we have agencies like the FDA to kind of keep an eye on them. From your reporting here and your story, I was kind of really shocked and disappointed that the FDA really missed it here. What happened there?
Because of COVID, the FDA missed 1 year's inspection. Okay. They inspect infant formula plants every year. So they missed one. And when they went in September of 2021, they saw some troubling signs, but they didn't elevate it to a warning for Abbott. They didn't request that Abbott recall any product or, you know, do anything at all other than try to fix the problems on its own. Then a whistleblower from the plant sent a report to the FDA outlining problems at the plant, not mentioning Cronobacter, this particular bacteria, but describing a place where procedures were sometimes shortcut, as you said, where rules were sometimes bent, and where people weren't always held to account when they should have been. This report, had the FDA taken it seriously enough, could have also, you know, brought the inspectors back into the plant sooner than it did. That report, the FDA said, was lost in their mailroom.
Lost in the mailroom.
Lost in the mailroom.
So where are we?
You know, the other element that really raises, though, is this thing where companies can almost self-police, but, you know, Abbott has ended up in a place that is actually a little different than a lot of other companies. Talk to us about that development, Susan, because that they basically, FDA stepped in and said, yeah, we have oversight now.
Yes, you know, as the shortage really became a crisis for a lot of families, and as the FDA's confidence in Abbott that it could clean up its plant waned, Abbott entered into a consent decree with the Department of Justice, and it gives the FDA extraordinary oversight of the plant's operations and required the plant to make changes to almost every way that it operates.
Legal issues. What are the legal issues facing Abbott here, because they're really worse than just a huge inconvenience, plus a lot worse.
Yeah, so, you know, the Cronobacter did get into some formula, we think. And of course, it's a little bit hard to prove exactly, you know, that kids who were sick had formula that we know was recalled, but to find the contaminant, which is, you know, small cells, is not always easy. But there were two kids who died. There were two kids who were sickened. Those four cases the FDA investigated. We came across other cases. And those families are suing Abbott. Altogether, they're facing about 24 lawsuits. Of course, they're operating under a consent decree for the next 5 years with the Department of Justice. And the FDA itself is under investigation by the Office of the Inspector General.
That was Bloomberg News senior investigative reporter Susan Burfield, along with the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber, on this week's cover story. Also joining us, Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney.
And the baby formula crisis exemplifies our next guest's point. Our world is built around convenience and innovation, but we're not always prepared for what nature has in store.
Engineers have given us this illusion that we can basically use technology to construct all these systems. And for the short term, yes, they work fine. But in the long term, the stress is going to build up eventually. And that's what we have to be conscious of.
Professor Salim Ali breaks down how natural laws define human life. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
All right, so we've talked a lot about energy, alternative energy, and the environment this week. It's a topic taking on renewed importance with President Biden having recently signed legislation that included billions of dollars in climate change initiatives.
With some thoughts on how natural and social system science can inform planetary crises, we turn to Salim Ali, Distinguished Professor of Energy and the Environment at the University of Delaware.
He's the author of a new book, Earthly Order, How Natural Laws Define Human Life. We started by asking about the meaning behind the title.
It's basically looking at some of the fundamental constraints that the planet has on us. So, when we talk about markets are ultimately dependent on some aspect of natural resource constraints. We're going back to the basic laws of nature, essentially, and making sure that we align our economic and social systems in congruence with those constraints.
I've talked about this before on air, so listeners will be familiar with it, but I grew up in California, and I had a professor in college. I went to college in Maine. A professor in college who said, California is a place where nobody should ever have lived because of the lack of water and the wildfires. And I'm wondering, Professor, if the market is failing in that sense, because you see California home prices still just out of control. And I say to myself, wait a second, and this is somebody who has family in California, why are people living in a place where there is no water?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to that classic Hollywood film Chinatown, you know, it goes to that kind of the heart of that challenge in California in terms of water security. And one could say the same of Phoenix, Arizona. I mean, so many places where we have designed human habitation without really considering the natural constraints there, and especially the number of people who live there. I mean, perhaps you could have some level of population, but that's a good example of that. And engineers have given us this illusion that we can basically use technology to construct all these systems. And for the short term, yes, they work fine. But in the long term, the stress is going to build up eventually. And that's what we have to be conscious of.
And I do wonder about this order and the things that are so connected, and maybe, and how we teach it to our younger generation. Like, how do we need to be rethinking things? Because, you know, I'm listening to you speak, and I've been thinking about, is it time for us to tell the world, back off, stop consuming so much, because Earth can't handle it? Like, I've really been thinking about, we're such a consumption-led society, but it's really being brought down as a result.
Yeah, you know, I am very much, approaching this from a practical point of view. We are going to need to consume in order to sustain livelihoods, but we need to move towards constructive consumption rather than having consumption which is not considering some of those natural constraints. So I'm all for green growth. I mean, there are many ways in which you can use the capitalist system in a very constructive way. But what we have done is we've not really considered some of those fundamental constraints that physics puts on us. I mean, for example, many years ago, you know, in the 1960s, 70s, there was an economist who wrote a book. It was published by Harvard University Press. It was called The Entropy Law in Economics. His name was Nicolas Georgescu-Rogin. And what it tried to do was to link some of those physical constraints to economics. But unfortunately, we lost our way at some point. And we could have great growth. We could have markets functioning, but we just need to do them within those constraints.
So then think when we're seeing the constraints of energy supplies as a result of the Russian war into Ukraine, that we shouldn't necessarily release supplies, produce more, because ultimately it's a fixed commodity. At some point it's going to run out. But let innovation, disruption happen.
part of it is that we are also very knee-jerk in our approach to looking at even environmental problems. And so it's not just, I don't want to just put all the blame on the markets. I think environmentalists share the blame that they don't make science-based decisions. So for example, with the war in Ukraine, you know, 3 weeks ago, Europe had to pass new legislation to basically classify nuclear energy as clean energy. And that's because they completely had this panic attack after Fukushima, and they didn't consider that actually from a natural science perspective, nuclear power, especially existing nuclear power plants, which were already operating, mm-hmm. made a lot of sense to provide baseload power. And now they have no baseload power, so they have to either be importing gas from Russia or they have to reclassify nuclear. So the environmentalists share this blame that we do not have science-based decision-making. We have what I call environmental awareness, but we don't have environmental literacy. I really want to make the connection between pragmatism and consumerism.
That was Salim Ali, Distinguished Professor of Energy and the Environment at the University of Delaware. His book, Earthly Order, How Natural Laws Define Human Life, it is out now.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, is the pet health and wellness market starting to soften after so many of us found new furry friends during the pandemic?
I found one of those new furry friends. I'm just going to put that out there. We're going to sit down with the CEO of Petco. We're going to talk outlook and the reasons for a tougher quarterly earnings report. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of Petco sold off following earnings this week after the company cut its adjusted earnings per share and net revenue guidance for the full year. An analyst at Baird called the pet health and wellness giant's forecast reset, quote, much needed.
So to find out more about the company's miss and where it goes from here amid persistent inflation and a tight labor market, Bloomberg Surveillance co-host Paul Sweeney and I spoke with Petco chairman and CEO Ron Coughlin.
Great companies grow even in tough economies. So we had a 4% comp, which is a good number. You know, we did not have the inventory issues that other companies are talking about. Most retailers are talking about inventory, excess inventory, and having to discount. We didn't have that situation. We continue to see a positive mix shift towards premium and super premium brands. So a lot of good news, but at the same time, there is some pressure from the inflation on discretionary items like toys, tennis balls, leashes. And that pressure, that's our highest profit area, so that puts some pressure on the P&L.
So in your P&L, on your P&L, talk to us about, I guess, inflation in terms of your cost of goods sold. Where do you guys see it in your P&L?
Yeah, so freight would be a big one. Labor would be another one. Labor we pretty much have in our model, but you know, I don't think anybody had the freight inflation that we saw in their model because the gas, you know, really popped in March, April type time.
It coming down, is it helping you?
It's starting to come down.
Yeah.
But the freight gets tied to the inventory, so it doesn't show up in the P&L till later in Q3 and into Q4.
I actually have been in a store on Second Avenue, bought a bunch of toys. I want to do a shout out to Cheddarly, who was really lovely because I have a dog, a puppy that chews through things in 30 seconds. So I came up with an armful of toys and I said, help me, what's going to, you know, last? And she was really wonderful. I have to say though, I noticed a lot of empty shelves and I was curious in the dog toy area, is it supply chain problems? What was it? Or is it just people... I don't know. It looked like you were sold out.
You know, there's not a single vendor that said, I think there's going to be a million new pets in 2020, another million new pets in 21, and elevated pets this year.
Yeah.
So all of the vendors have been scaling their manufacturing. The bad news is that the supply lagged the demand. The good news is that supply and capacity is coming up now. I was in a brand new plant in Dallas for Honest Kitchen. Hills just announced major investments in their manufacturing. So that capacity, it really takes about 2 years to get new capacity up, and that capacity is coming up now. We're seeing improving supply week after week.
Talk to us about the demand side of this business, the pet business. It seemed like during the pandemic, a lot of folks went out and got themselves a pet, a cat, a dog, something like that. I'm not sure where those owners are today, where those pets are today, but how did that impact your business and how are you dealing with it today?
Well, if you look at our business, we're up 34% on a three-year basis. Yep. Our e-com business is up 140%. Services business up 60%. So we have scaled tremendously on the back of that. But make no mistake about it. Today, 2022, the predictions are for it to still be elevated in terms of pet adoptions versus 2019 pre-pandemic. And those stories about there being more relinquishments are really just stories. Relinquishments are below pre-pandemic. So the supply of pet and the pet universe is only growing. And we tend to do better in terms of capturing more than our fair share of new pets.
So why don't you guys pull in your guidance?
It's really that pressure on disposable income.
That's it.
And supplies. Yeah. If you look at our food, our food's up double digits.
Yeah.
You look at our
in terms of growth or sales?
Growth. Yeah. You look at our services, up double digits. It's really that segment of supplies, toys, balls, leashes, collars, that kind of thing. The rest of the business is highly, highly recession resistant. And as I said, we continue to trade up, whether that's in food to premium kibble or fresh frozen, or even our Ready fashion brand, that was up double digit, which is kind of a higher end supplies brand.
Do you talk recession at all?
Of course we do. We have to plan for every eventuality.
Do you expect it?
A story the other day, 70% prediction of recession. So we need to be planful for that.
Yeah.
So we're doing two things. One is making sure that our cost structure is prepared to navigate through that. And the second thing is making
sure. What does that mean?
There's hiring components. There's location components. There's travel components. You cut back in all the areas that aren't revenue generating, direct revenue generating, to make sure that if your revenue is impacted, your cost structure is not out of line with your revenue profile. The second piece, though, is making sure you're more attractive to customers who are going through a recession, right? Mm-hmm. So things like bundles, right? Bundled tennis balls, things like our Vital Care program, which is a membership program that gets discounts across our portfolio. People can save $300 with that program. Mega packs. Mm-hmm. So you change your offering or you adjust your offering for the consumer mindset as they navigate through a recession.
Well, I share a condo building with Harry, who is a pit bull with a very bad attitude and anger management problems that he needs to work on. But in any case, he gets his Chewy delivery every week or two. Talk to us about your digital business, how you deal with some of those online competitors, and kind of how your business is faring.
Well, first of all, we can help Harry with our trainers. Our trainers are excellent and get his attitude in the right place. We also have repeat delivery, and our repeat delivery business is growing significantly ahead of the competitor that you mentioned. Yep. That's part of our recurring revenue plays, and recurring revenue is important in terms of line of sight to revenue. So our recurring revenue customer growth was 54%. So it was very, very strong. We love those customers because it's a guaranteed customer and very sticky.
Well, that's what I'm curious about, retention. So it sounds like once you've got somebody within the Petco network, they tend to stay, or do they?
We've had very strong retention. The dynamic right now is we continue to bring in new customers. So one of the strengths in the quarter was we brought in 325,000 new customers into our franchise.
Wow.
The competitor that you mentioned bled customers last quarter.
Is that unusual, that number?
This is our 14th consecutive quarter in a row adding customers. So we've continued to add customers, which speaks to the strength of our model and our marketing.
Well, how often is it you bring somebody in for either a vet visit or some grooming and they're going to buy something? Yeah.
When we put a vet hospital in one of our stores, we get a 4 to 5 point center store lift in merchandise. That's despite taking out 2,500 square feet of merchandise footage. But we still get a 4 to 5 point lift because of the traffic and also because of the type of customer that is going in to see a vet. They're the higher end customers.
How many stores do you have today?
Yeah, around 1,450.
And they're all U.S., right?
We're number one in Mexico, offline.
Okay.
And then we have an initiative with Canadian Tire for some store in stores.
Okay, so how do you see your store count as a part of your growth story? Are we adding stores here? Is there geographic areas you need to get into or muscle up in?
Yeah, so we've done the culling where there was less profitable. Okay. Now we're back into a growth mode. We'll add 15 in the back half of this year, partially those small town rural stores that I talked about, which we're very excited about. It's an $8 billion addressable market for us, and some high growth geographies.
Are you guys competing increasingly with other private equity? Because it does, I feel like I know my vet, who used to be a standalone, has been swooped up in like these networks of vets.
There's been a lot of private equity action in the vet space, which gives us our opportunity because there's very high multiples being paid for those vets.
Yeah.
So after you pay that kind of money, then there's a lot of pressure to upgrade efficiency.
They're not as
sales,
much fun, I'm
going to
tell you. After offense, the PE guys.
We love our PE.
I know you do. I know you do.
CVC and CPP have been phenomenal.
I know you do.
But that said, we have a different approach. We allow the vets to practice medicine as they see fit, which is important.
One thing I want to ask you, where's growth going forward? Because you do have some international exposure, Ron. So where do you continue to grow?
Yeah. We have a $40 billion addressable market that we're just leaning into. So if you look at the vet market, it's a $30 billion market.
It's massive.
We only have 200 vets stores so far. We said we're going to get up to 700, 800 vets. So that's one area. The second thing is small town rural. I talked about an $8 billion market. That is exploding from a population standpoint. Our first store is doing very, very well. You'll see us lean into that. Third is RX. RX is a scale addressable market. Again,
It's a mess in general.
There's a
like,
lot of
I think
of
there's ways to make it easier, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And provide a holistic solution there. And then the last thing I would cite is insurance. Insurance, if you go to Europe, insurance is about 10% penetrated for pet parent. Here it's 2-3% penetrated. So we have an offer. It's growing double digit, but we can go even faster, and we'll have some news shortly on that front.
When you look at what seems to be conflicting signals around within our economy, whether it's labor data, or labor data seems to be very strong, but you see continued weakness within the housing market and other areas, how do you see it, or how does it kind of factor what you do in terms of your longer term strategy at the company?
In terms of the here and now, navigating through choppy waters, our plan is to navigate through what we assume are going to be similar economic environment to today. Right, we're not economists. We say, okay, well, let's assume this is going to be steady state for 6-12 months. How would we navigate through that? And that's part of the revised conservative guide that we put out today. Was let's make sure that in this environment we can deliver or over deliver. From a long term strategy standpoint, our long term strategy is a winner. Right, the category is going to grow 7%. We continue to gain share in areas like super premium, gain share in vet, gain share in digital. Basically, where all the profit pools are.
That's Petco Chairman and CEO Ron Coughlin, Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney joining us there as well. And we had a long, in-depth conversation, so go to our podcast feed to hear it in its entirety. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Ahead in our next hour, we're focusing on venture capital. We hear from the CEO of Incredible Health on her firm's latest funding round.
That includes an NBA star. And then a VC veteran tells us what's piquing her interest and pulling at her firm's purse strings.
Plus, Amazon's latest billion-dollar streaming bet. Stick around. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a VC update on a newly minted unicorn in the healthcare space, and then one venture capitalist that's working to digitize the physical world.
Plus, a crop of startups are touting the medical benefits of psychedelic drugs. We'll explain why solid science could be taking a backseat to unbridled capitalist ambitions as these companies race to market.
Tim, we're talking mushrooms.
Yeah, we're talking mushrooms again.
They're all over the place. First up this hour, one company that's managed to defy tough conditions. Last week, Johns Hopkins joined Andreessen Horowitz, Kaiser Permanente, NBA star Andre Iguodala, and others in an $80 million Series B funding round for Incredible Health, pushing that company into unicorn status.
The platform connects hospitals with nurses and other healthcare workers. Carol Ann, Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld, spoke with co-founder and CEO Dr. Iman Abuzaid about the new cash infusion.
So it means that we're now the highest valued tech-enabled career marketplace for healthcare workers in the U.S. today. Our valuation is at $1.65 billion. And for the first time, we've had our customers, health systems, including Kaiser Permanente and Johns Hopkins, invest in our round two, which really positions us as the leaders in healthcare hiring.
So maybe an obvious question, but this latest round, $80 million, what will you be using the money on?
So we're using the money in three key areas. First is in R&D, you know, so investing in the hiring workflow and automating it with machine learning technology. And that includes automating the screening, automating the matching, just so it's increasingly more personalized and more automated for both the healthcare workers and the employers. We're also going to be investing in career resources for nurses. And so they're using us over the course of their entire career. That includes skill growth, scheduling services, educational scholarships, cross-training, all of which is completely free of charge for nurses. And so we are the place where they manage their careers. And then, frankly, just, you know, expansion. You know, expansion beyond nurses and beyond hospitals. Because right now we're serving those two markets primarily and have ambitions to support the rest of the healthcare workers and healthcare employers, too.
Explore the platform with our audience to remind them exactly what you are doing, who is on it, how many people, and really the growth that you are seeing month to month.
Sure. Hospitals and other healthcare employers, they use Incredible Health custom matching technology to hire high quality permanent nurses in less than 14 days instead of the industry average of 82 days. We save each hospital facility that we work with at least $2 million in travel nurse costs, overtime costs, and HR costs. And the nurses using our platform enjoy an average salary increase of about 15% and reductions in commute time. I guess over the last year, in 2021, we grew top-line revenue over 500%. We've now expanded to over 600 hospitals across 25 states. We work with very large health systems, including HCA Healthcare and Kaiser Permanente. We also work with academic medical centers like Stanford, Cedars-Sinai, and Johns Hopkins. And we have over 10,000 nurses joining our platform every single week.
And that industry average of 82 days, which you've shortened to 14 days, how does 82 days, that average now, compare to what we've seen in the past? I guess what I'm asking is, did the pandemic exacerbate that? Has that average grown longer?
The pandemic has definitely exacerbated that number, so that average has gotten longer. Because we are continuing to face a very severe labor shortage in nursing and as well as other healthcare professions. And then the other key number that pandemic has impacted is turnover. The average turnover for nurses in the U.S. was about 17% before the pandemic. It's now on average 21.5%.
Well, tell us a little bit about it. I was talking to somebody within the nursing community and just said COVID, monkeypox, you name it. Women, individuals, men, people who are in the nursing field have just kind of had it. Have we lost, or how many have we lost from this field?
So we are we're increasingly losing nurses from this field. So our third annual data report from earlier this year showed that one third of nurses are considering leaving the profession permanently by the end of 2022. And so this is a workforce that has been negatively impacted, in some cases, you know, decimated by the pandemic. They are being overworked and experiencing extreme fatigue and stress and burnout at the moment.
And how do you address retention then, if, you know, burnout is such a big issue?
So a couple key ways. First, are the employers using our platform enjoy a 15% increase in their baseline retention rates? Because the nurse was able to consider multiple opportunities before selecting that specific employer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we also, in our surveys and our data, shows that the top reasons why nurses are changing jobs is by far the number one is career advancement. They're looking for more career advancement. They want to grow their skills, move into leadership, cross-train,
right.
Become more specialized. And so the hospitals and health systems that are investing in career advancement for nurses are enjoying better retention rates.
A big thanks to Dr. Iman Abu-Zaid, CEO and co-founder at Incredible Health. Katie Greifeld taking part there as well. By the way, she did mention to us that the company's ultimate goal is to go public. We're certainly hoping to hear more from them down the line.
Feels like she continues to take big steps towards that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right, still ahead, we'll check in on the broader health of venture capital in 2022 and where investors are looking to place their bets.
Eclipse Ventures partner Aidan Madigan-Curtis joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Last month, Bloomberg reported that global funding for startups fell 23% in the second quarter from the first. The total number dwindled to $108.5 billion. So where are the people with deep pockets and an appetite for risk supposed to find opportunity? Our next guest has some ideas.
She certainly does. Aidan Madigan Curtis is a partner at Eclipse Ventures. It's a venture capital firm focusing on essential industries diving big into the digital age. Aidan was part of the team at Apple that scaled up the first ever Apple Watch. She joined me and Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld. We started, though, with an update on the overall VC environment.
For what it's worth, you know, while we did see funding kind of in VC drop as a whole, 23% quarter over quarter last quarter, it was also the sixth largest quarter of VC funding into startups ever.
Wow.
And I think, you know, we're talking about $105 billion into sort of, you know, great new companies. And I think that even in some of the toughest times, we see some really exceptional companies getting built. For example, you know, LinkedIn was started in 02, as was Atlassian and Procore, or Airbnb in 08 and Twilio in 08. I think, you know, sometimes the very best companies actually get built when times are toughest.
And Aidan, I'm looking over the notes that you sent us, and you write that physical industries are ripe for VC investment. What exactly is a physical industry?
Sure thing. Yeah, it's actually really fascinating. If you look at the, you know, talking about kind of industry stats, the $625 billion in VC investment that went out last year, you know, well over 80% of that is invested in, you know, areas like in fintech or enterprise SaaS or e-commerce or biotech. When we're talking about physical industries, we are talking about the basic foundations of our society, industries like manufacturing, transportation, the delivery of actual healthcare, or even supply chains, things that make up over 40% of global GDP. And in terms of how we think about it and why they're so ripe for investment, I think, you know, in many ways, COVID brought to light just how rigid so many of our supply chains are. And the geopolitical climate of the last year or so has also really shown a light on how globalization, while, you know, transformative in so many ways and really deflationary in a good way for the last, you know, 30 years worth of consumer power, has also made us very interconnected and has, you know, made us very interdependent. So we're really focused on digital transformation of some of those industries that underlie our basic infrastructure.
So what does that mean for something like, you know, either supply chains or manufacturing specifically? I mean, I love what you're talking, and it really resonates with me because I do feel like there are certain parts of our world that have been slow to innovate and be disrupted. But I agree with you. Crisis often leads, we saw it during the pandemic, to disruption and innovation and thinking about things in a different way. So how does this all lead and guide your investments? Talk companies for us, if you would.
100%. So if you think about where the vast majority of the world's manufacturing base is, it's no longer in the US. You know, manufacturing used to be 30% of US GDP. It's now 12% of US GDP. And that's a change, a shift that's happened in the last 25 years or so. Some of our portfolio companies are really focused on not just the concept of reshoring, but the notion of how do we actually bring real innovation to grow productivity in industries like manufacturing. For example, Vulcan Forms. It's a 3D metal additive technology using a very advanced laser structure that can actually make incredibly complex designs, for example, metal medical implants, or very small, tiny pieces to go into consumer electronics. And it can do it at 100 times the pace and the speed and throughput as traditional metal manufacturing. So that's a good example. That was a team out of MIT that we invested in several years ago. Greg Rykow is a partner at Eclipse and is a board member there. We've been watching their growth with great anticipation. There was a New York Times article on them just a month or two ago talking about the crazy advances that they're making in this space. Another good example, the company called Bright Machines. It's actually a technology that we collaborated on with Flextronics and took and turned it into its own standalone company, where essentially with just very simple software instructions, we can take a very modular approach to using robotics and software, creating full end-to-end manufacturing lines that can do really quick changeovers. And we can actually produce using that type of technology really fast and easy end outputs and assemblies with great flexibility. So that's a good example across manufacturing. We're also really heavily invested in modernizing things like transportation and bringing also a climate focus to some of those innovations. For example, mm-hmm. a company we've been working on called ARC Boats. It's a fully electric speedboat. We've also got an investment in a company called Axel Hire, which is a really rapid last mile logistics company. So you can sort of see across the chain, whether it's sort of end-to-end full stack approaches like ARC, which is an actual boat, an electric boat, mm-hmm. or whether it's something like Axel Hire, which is the software stack as well as the full end delivery, how we're trying to innovate across these different industries.
Well, let's situate this in the macroeconomic environment that we're currently in, which is one with a lot of fears about recession. And when you're thinking about sort of these innovative businesses that you're looking to, how concerned are you that a recession, should it descend on the economy, would sort of stop some of that innovation in its tracks?
Yeah, I actually think innovation is really one of our only key ways out of a pretty, pretty dark looking economic time. If you think about the power of what, it sounds funny, but hydrocarbons did, from the 1950s to the 1970s, they actually allowed us to relatively cheaply really fuel crazy economic growth and crazy economic development. Globalization in the last 30 years has allowed us to reduce labor costs and actually produce much more for far less. These are the key elements that create growth. It's essentially being able to, through productivity and lower cost inputs, produce more output.
That's Aidan Madigan Curtis. She's a partner at Eclipse Ventures. Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld with us there as well.
Up next on Bloomberg Business Week, we are still talking startups, a very specific type of startup, why many new market players want to get in on psychedelics.
I think one of the things that we forget when we talk about magic mushrooms, MDMA, all of the psychedelics that are really having a moment right now is that there is still so much we don't know. You know, coming to market smoothly will rely in part on figuring out some of these basic science questions.
Inside the race to grow, monetize, and even patent the greatest shrooms, you do not want to miss this. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
A recent takeover of the Pursuit section of Bloomberg Business Week, it included a set of stories about the growing economy for various types of mushrooms. Among them are the kind you will not find in the produce section of your local supermarket, at least, Tim, not yet.
This week, our features team examines the growing business of so-called magic mushrooms. It's among the various types of psychedelic drugs that could have legitimate medical benefits. And a series of young companies are banking on it.
Yeah, a lot of them. The problem is some of the firms racing to market might be getting ahead of themselves. Drake Bennett and Kristen V. Brown co-wrote the story for Business Week. Kristen is a healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News. She and Business Week editor Joel Weber joined me and Katie Greifeld of Bloomberg with a primer on the challenges facing these fungi fanatics.
There is still so much we don't know. You know, these drugs were originally being explored back in the 50s and 60s as things that could really have a positive impact on mental health. But then in the late 60s, early 70s, we cracked down on them. Experimentation basically came to a grinding halt. And we had all these decades where we just weren't exploring how these drugs work. And so even though we've had these fantastic clinical trial results that show really breathtaking numbers of people who have been helped by these drugs for disorders like PTSD and depression, we still don't understand at a very basic level how the drugs work. And I think coming to market smoothly will rely in part on figuring out some of these basic science questions.
I mean, I cover marijuana stocks all the time, for example, and they have just been beaten and beaten up in the market, mostly due to regulatory concerns. I would imagine in psychedelics, it's even more dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, there are some concerns. Studies have shown that these drugs are in large part very safe, but in specific instances, for example, people with histories of suicidal ideation or maybe people who have psychotic illnesses like schizophrenia that run in their family, there could be a high-risk component. Plus, you know, there's just all of the decades of cultural baggage that go with these drugs. So there is definitely wanting to keep safety in mind. Plus, this has already come out a little bit as we move forward in clinical trials. There, you know, when you have a therapist in a room with somebody who's like out of their mind tripping, there's also a lot of potential for abuse, which is true in any healthcare scenario, right? So I do think that there is one segment of this industry, of this leg of science, that is wanting to, you know, go slow and steady and make sure that as we roll these drugs out to people, that we're not only trying to roll them out quickly so that we're getting them to people soon who are in desperate need of drugs to, you know, treat some of these disorders, but we're also doing it safely so that we don't wind up in a situation where something terrible happens and then there's, you know, backlash to deal with.
What's it look like from an investment standpoint right now?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. You know, I just checked my notebook here. One estimate puts that this industry could be at about $6.9 billion in a few years. So huge, huge, huge market potential. But one of the things that's interesting about psychedelics that's, you know, sort of different from your average pharmaceutical company's playbook is that you're dealing with things that have been in existence for a long time. So you have to figure out where the IP is. And people are taking different approaches. Compass Pathways, their strategy has been to try and create a novel psilocybin molecule, right? So they're tweaking the sort of crystalline structure in the lab. They're synthesizing it and tweaking that structure and saying it's something new. But then you have people pushing back and saying, well, it's not actually something new. You're just riffing on something old. So the debate gets very complicated there. And then there's other companies that are saying, we're not even going to deal with trying to prove that our, you know, version of this thing that has been in existence forever is new. We're going to instead find IP in other places. You know, this one company, Numinous, their strategy is, we're going to come up with a way to grow the mushrooms super efficiently, and we're going to patent that.
What does the Bloomberg audience, investors who are interested in this, need to know in terms of some of these startups? I feel like you just laid out some of it.
This is definitely going to be a really hot space. The question is, what form will these drugs take when they come to market? Is it going to be, you know, a totally new drug that we make by taking some elements of psychedelics and turning them something new into a laboratory? Or is it going to be just finding the right platform to roll out psychedelic mushrooms in their original form? I think that's the big question, is not will these things help people, but how.
Our thanks to Bloomberg News healthcare reporter Kristen V. Brown and Business Week editor Joel Weber for that report. And our thanks once again to Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, you'll need to read this week's Pursuit section of the magazine so you will know what to watch on TV in the weeks and the coming months. Tim, there's a lot coming our way.
Yeah, there certainly is. Fans of Game of Thrones are in for something, right?
Yeah, it's rolling out.
The Bloomberg Screen Time squad on the latest salvos from the streaming wars, including a 10-figure bet from Amazon on the one show to rule them all.
Maybe we'll find our newest obsession. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We're wrapping up our broadcast, as we often do, with a dive into the Pursuit section of Bloomberg Business Week. Don't tell anybody, Tim, but it's always my favorite.
All right. Well, now everyone knows because you just said it.
I know.
They bring us the best of food, travel, and luxury of all kinds. This week, they're taking us to the front lines of the streaming wars and latest big budget projects from some of our favorite entertainment heavyweights.
That's right. We're talking about everything from Hulu's Mike Tyson drama to Amazon's Lord of the Rings prequel. The section opener asks the question, are we entering the blockbuster era of streaming or finally hitting the summit of peak TV?
To break it down, we've got Bloomberg News media, entertainment, and telecom editor Felix Gillette, along with Pursuit's deputy editor Jim Gaddy, joining us now. Okay, Jim, I want to start with you because a lot of the programs that we're going to be talking about, namely Amazon's huge Lord of the Rings prequel, and by huge, I mean expensive as well, these were put into motion before, you know, Netflix kind of fell apart a few months ago.
Yeah, you know, this has been one of Jeff Bezos' kind of pet projects himself, a Tolkien super fan. Felix did some deep diving into this process. Felix, what really surprised you about this whole saga?
You know, you see these huge projects, including this Lord of the Rings prequel from Amazon, landing at this interesting time in streaming. Netflix has The Sandman, which is also a big budget sci-fi show that just landed. HBO has The House of the Dragon, which is the Game of Thrones prequel. Disney Plus has She-Hulk. All these hugely expensive streaming shows landing at this very precarious moment in the streaming era, where all these studios are under a lot of pressure to cut back. You know, you're seeing layoffs at HBO Max and at Netflix. And so it's this interesting contrast, like, which way is this whole thing going? Like, are we going into these huge, we're going to do more and more big blockbuster series, or is this kind of like the grand finale and everybody's going to be like, yeah, maybe we'll just, not make $1 billion TV shows?
All right, I'm so confused because I thought this was the era of get off your couch, the pandemic is over, and go right. Live life, everybody. But that's okay, that's okay. We're all going to be pulled back to streaming. Felix, one thing I thought, just to kind of get going in terms of what Amazon is doing with the Rings of Power, Jeff Bezos really into this.
Yes, he is a big Tolkien super fan himself, and he was very involved in the beginning pushing Amazon to pay $250 million just for the rights to make five seasons of a show, plus a potential spinoff down the road. But that was, 5 years ago. And this thing has been in the works now for 5 years. It's been shot mainly in New Zealand. At some point, the New Zealand government revealed that the first season alone was going to cost, approximately $465 million in production fees. So it's this huge bet by Amazon. They really haven't, it's fascinating to watch the evolution of their original streaming strategy, because when you think back, a decade ago when they launched Amazon Prime Video, at that point they were all about, oh, we're going to disrupt the way Hollywood does production, and we're going to open it up to everybody, and we're going to set up this portal on the website where anybody can upload a screenplay, and we'll, democratize the whole process. And, that is where they started, and then 10 years later, you've gotten to the point where they're making the most expensive TV show ever. So it's been kind of a fascinating journey. And, Jeff Bezos has been right in there. Basically, about, 5, 6, 7 years ago, he started telling everybody, his Hollywood executives, he's like, go out and get me my Game of Thrones. So at that point, Game of Thrones was kind of ruling over home entertainment, and he really wanted that. He wanted Amazon to have something huge that was a global event, that would cross culture, that could help Amazon Prime make inroads into all these different countries around the world. And so it is, it's the biggest bet that Amazon has made in the home entertainment space, and we'll see how it goes.
I'm wondering if the stakes are different for Amazon, because at the end of the day, Amazon is a company that makes, its profits from selling server space through AWS and, getting us to buy more toilet paper. If we're
and my
Amazon
Peloton
Prime
now,
customers.
Apparently.
Yeah, and your Peloton now, too. But you already have one, Carol, so I guess you don't need to buy another one
for Amazon.
Well,
I can get the treadmill or something. I don't know.
Are the stakes different for Amazon than they are for a pure-play entertainment company like Disney or Netflix or,
Yeah, they're definitely different. I mean, they're not just about getting viewing time. They're about pulling people into the whole Amazon ecosystem, and this is a huge lure for them. But at the same time, I think it is an interesting test of kind of the Amazon flywheel synergy thing, where, in theory, they have all of these software and hardware assets that they should be able to use to make this Lord of the Rings prequel into this huge global event. I mean, they have Twitch, the popular, live streaming site. They have IMDb.com. They have all these Fire TV devices everywhere. They should be able to kind of use all of those assets to really push people to watch the series and to promote it and to market it. They haven't done an amazing job in the past of marketing their original series. So I think it's also a fascinating test of that. Can they get all these different assets working on the same page. And if they can't, and they can't do it for something with this kind of intellectual pedigree, this kind of built-in fan base, this kind of pre-recognition among fans, then I don't see how they could ever do it.
All right, so we've got House of the Dragon. That's coming from Amazon. We've got The Sandman coming from Netflix. We've got She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, Disney Plus series. There's lots of stuff coming at us. I want to get to some of the other stuff in Pursuits because you guys cover so much. There's stuff on Mike Tyson. There's also George Miller with a new film. Give us some other things that are coming our way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny talking about this Lord of the Rings series, Rings of Power. Nobody knows if it's going to be any good.
Oh, come on.
I mean, there's no Peter Jackson involved. You know, if it's really good, then it'll pay back everything. But nobody really knows. What we do know is that the new Mike Tyson docudrama is not very good.
Wow.
We watched it.
Yeah.
we had a guy, one of our regular contributors, who was a boxing trainer and has followed Mike Tyson's career, went and looked at this new series. It's from the people who did I, Tonya, mm-hmm. which got a lot of really positive feedback and critical reception, I guess. Two things he took issue with in this series. One, Mike Tyson was not involved, which doesn't make a ton of sense considering how good of a storyteller he is.
Yeah.
About his own story. He's done a one-man show, Undisputed Truth. He's got Spike Lee directed this HBO special about it. He's over and over again. He's got a podcast that he's very, very compelling storyteller himself. And they didn't go to him. He's pretty upset about it. If you go and read his tweets, I won't quote them on the radio. But, you know, I would think you would not want to make Mike Tyson angry.
Not like he bit somebody's ear off or anything.
Yeah, we got in a fight on an airplane recently.
Yeah. The second thing that he...
Sorry.
The second thing that he found he took issue with is that the most interesting character in the show is not Mike Tyson. It's Desiree Washington, who he went to jail over. That is a story that no one has really told. And so anyway, that's kind of how he ended his review, is like, you know, it's weird. You meet the most interesting character in this show, like five episodes in. The George Miller movie, which comes out this weekend, 3,000 Years of Longing, it stars Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton. George Miller is a really interesting character. How many directors do you know can make Babe and Happy Feet and Mad Max Fury Road?
No. Right. Not many.
You know, it's got his kind of trademark, you know, magic. He's just got this really interesting kind of point of view. And it's not totally perfect. Our reviewer did not, if you felt like it kind of sagged at the end. But,
yeah.
You know, anything George Miller makes is worth going to see, even if it's not necessarily, you know, 10 out of 10.
Ken I wanted Burns. To talk about some of the other documentaries that you feature, because you have one about lacrosse from kind of a character that Carol and I are very familiar with, who's come on our program
Paul
before.
Rabel, yeah.
Yeah. And then also Linsanity, which brings me back like a decade ago.
it brings me back too, Tim. It's one of the only times in the last 10 years where the Knicks have mattered during the season and not, you know, and during the off season when they're trying to guess
Brutal.
Which superstar is going to come.
Felix, what are you going to watch?
I'm excited about House of the Dragon. You'll be watching the Game of Thrones prequel. And I will be watching The Rings of Power.
Check
that out.
That'll keep you busy. What about you, Jim?
I'm going to go see Bad Bunny this weekend.
No comment. Also in this section, there's a great Q&A with Ken Burns about the United States' role with the Holocaust. That really, I had no idea, and it really stopped me. So we highly recommend you check out. And also, what's going on when people get out bands on the road? Interesting take on what's going on there.
That's Bloomberg News Media, Entertainment, and Telecom editor Felix Gillette. Also Pursuit's deputy editor Jim Gaddy. And a big shout out to Katie Greifeld and Paul Sweeney for helping us out so much this past week.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And also check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal.
You can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
A lot of things to watch over the next coming weeks. This is Bloomberg.